Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station where you'll only hear the female voice.
Coming up now is our author of the week, Deborah Cohen. Her book, Family Secrets, Living with Shame from the Victorians to the Present Day, deals with shame and how that's changed. What we find shameful or shocking or strange now is very different from what we found 100 years ago. And Deborah has unearthed some really fascinating secrets. For example, in the 1860s, think about that, 1 in 10 children at boarding school were half black or Asian. And disabled children in Victorian times were completely socially acceptable and cherished, whereas in the 1950s and 60s, disabled children were, you know, hidden away, not spoken about, sort of denied. Deborah was born into a family with its own fair share of secrets, which she'll share with us happily. We love gossip. She was raised in Kentucky and educated at Harvard and Berkeley, and she teaches at Northwestern University, where she holds the Peter B. Ritzma Professorship of the Humanities. Her last book was the award-winning Household Gods, a history of the British love affair with the home. Here she is.
So I'm very happy to welcome into the studio a historian who lives in the States and is presently the Peter B. Ritzma Professor of Humanities and Professor of History in the Department of History in Northwestern University. She is Deborah Cohen, and she has written a book called Family Secrets, Living with Shame from Victorians to Present Day. This is not Deborah's first book. She's very interested in what I term real history. The history of people, how they think, talk and respond. Her other books are Household Gods, The British and Their Possessions, and The War Come Home, Disabled Veterans in Britain and Germany, 1914 to 1939. So it's the British you seem to find fascinating, Deborah.
That's right. Well, thank you so much for having me. First of all, it's really a pleasure to be here. That's right. I'm an American historian of Britain, but there are lots of us, actually, as it turns out. There are thousands of us in North America.
Why do you think that is? Why Britain?
Well, I think that it's not only the imperial part of Britain's history, but it's also the long connection with the States, mm-hmm. you know, that led mm-hmm. lots of people into British history.
Yeah.
A lot of history departments these days are very global. And for
So they include it. Yeah. And what about you
personally,
Deborah? How did you get on the journey?
I grew up in a way, an Edwardian household. So my childhood reading was Arthur Ransom, and my father was very much of an Edwardian character. So, you know, Aubrey Beardsley, Wilde, a particular kind of, you know, late Victorian Edwardian sensibility.
Yeah.
So for me, in a way, it was natural. And so I had a set of literary interests in Britain that I was then able to parlay into being a historian.
So the word shame, I think, is particularly resonant for the English. Do you think we feel it more than other cultures?
I don't think so, actually. I mean, I think in a way the question is how middle class is shame, right? How related to class is shame, and particularly to upper echelons of society? Well, I think that there are differences between particular variants of American and German and French and British shame. I think that, you know, that probably respectability and class, you know, are more central.
Yes, yes. So that's really the starting point of the book, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. It's a book about middle-class people and middle-class families, not exclusively. But as I say in the book, you know, it's only the middle class for much of the 19th century who can actually afford to keep a secret. And so in a way, you know, you can think about having a secret almost as a definition of what it means to be middle class, like having a servant.
And also the middle class were completely growing and they wanted respectability. I mean, that was the word, wasn't it?
That's right. And to be, and respectability was a value that eventually went very far down the social spectrum. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about the middle class aspirations to respectability and to live, you know, a life that was unimpeachable in many ways was what families then had to keep secret.
Yeah.
So the ways in which feeling ashamed and wanting to preserve the reputation of the family actually leads people to accept things within their households that they would have denied knowing anything about on the outside.
Fascinating. Let's start with the British in India. They had many secrets. Some of the men sort of went native out there, didn't they?
And that was a very common thing. So in the late 18th century, when these, you know, English and Scottish men went to India, there were almost no white British women there. And the relationships that they had were with Native women. And in fact, these relationships that in the first instance, the East India Company didn't actually frown upon.
I suppose because they wanted them to stay there, didn't they?
Right, yeah. Right. And to be able to be, to make households and to make alliances.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, what's interesting for the families of these men is that the kinds of households that they built in India were completely open there. So for instance, I talk about a man who was an army general named Cochrane, and he has really completely known to everyone a long, long time mistress and named Rahim Bibi. And then he goes on to take and to marry a white British wife and lives together with them and with his mixed race daughter. And again, this is an arrangement completely known to everyone in Calcutta, which is where he's living.
Mm-hmm.
But these were relationships with their Indian companions that British men kept secret from their families at home. So even when they would acknowledge actually having a mixed race child, they would not talk about the mother of this child.
So it was socially acceptable in India, but as soon as you came back to the UK, it didn't exist.
Right. And they sort of, in a way, they engaged in a kind of willful self-deception, because while they kept their relationships with Indian women secret from their families, oftentimes they hoped that they could send their children back and that relatives would take care of them.
And they did do that, didn't
and they?
They
did do that, right? Yeah. One of the cases that I talk about in the book, a really amazing case. In some ways, this is a fairy tale case. This is not typical.
Yeah.
But in 1786, the army captain, Robert Bruce, brought home from India a little girl who was 5 years old, whom he claimed to everyone was the daughter of a friend of his. And it was actually his own child that he'd had with his Indian companion. And he didn't want to tell his sister and brother in Edinburgh about this child, or his mother in Edinburgh about this child, because he feared that they wouldn't accept the child. In fact, his brother had said to him, "Don't send home such a child to me. It's impossible in Edinburgh society." And what's interesting about the Bruce family is, so Robert Bruce essentially comes out to them 2 years later and says, "Look, this child is my child, and it is the child that I've had with an Indian mistress." But instead of refusing to take in this child, they do. I mean, they take her into their household. They look after her. His mother and his sister tend her when she has fevers. They worry constantly about her. They fret about a darkening shadow on her upper lip because it's going to be the telltale sign of mixed race. And most of all, though, they worry about what Robert Bruce has told his Indian army companions. They worry whether everyone in Edinburgh doesn't already know this secret that they're so studiously trying to preserve. In the Bruce case, and this is what makes it a fairy tale, they protect this child. They make her their heir. They do everything to ensure that she has as much money as she can possibly have. She herself is an extremely wily and canny character, and she becomes one of the richest women in 19th century Scotland.
That's amazing.
Yeah, an incredible story.
And she also marries a respectable white man in the end.
That's right, she does, in part because she's an heiress. And everyone thinks that Ona Sepphoris Tyndall has married her for her money, this Margaret Bruce, whom, incidentally, she forces Ona Sepphoris to take her name as well.
Good honor.
Yeah, right, exactly. So this is a woman who as a child has come to the country without a name and then becomes someone who forces two gentry families successively to take her name.
It's fantastic. God. But then there also were unhappy stories.
That's right, tremendously unhappy stories. And important to bring these up. So in the case that I was talking about before, Cochrane, the army surgeon, his daughter Susan ends up effectively disinherited after battling basically her entire life to try to secure.
That's after he's died. Sort of
after he's died, exactly, exactly.
Yeah. People hold it against them.
And his new British wife refuses to share any part of the inheritance unless it's absolutely forced out of her. And that becomes a very typical story. And I think in some ways this, it's a heritage that really haunts the Victorians, because they, in stories and novels, return over and over again to the one figure who's absolutely erased from the story I've just been telling, which is the native mother. And she reappears in these Victorian little short stories as a kind of tragic figure who is going to haunt the family at home. She's the person who's been dispossessed, whose children have been torn out of her arms, literally by these men. as they bring them home. And so I think you can see a kind of guilt and shame that the families feel, and anxieties as well about what have men done abroad that they don't know about.
Then we move on to the divorce courts, which didn't really exist. I mean, when were they kind of invented? When
right.
did you start getting divorced?
In England and Wales, you could get a divorce before 1857, but only through a very arduous procedure that required ecclesiastical courts and an act of parliament. So it was something that was it was something really for the rich.
Yeah.
And when the divorce court was set up in 1857, the idea was that it was going to help make marriages even more moral and even better. Because the idea, as the Times confidently proclaimed in 1857, was that British marriages were really happy, and that English marriages were very happy, and that, in fact, they didn't need divorce because they were so happy. But maybe divorce would help those innocent parties, those very few innocent parties who were married to absolute rotters, to rid themselves of a marital bond that had gone sour. And so the whole idea was that in order to have a divorce, you had to have fault on the part of one person and one person alone.
And it had to be made very public, didn't it?
Exactly. And this is a really important part of the divorce court, which is the idea is that these bad bonds were going to be paraded in front of the entire nation through the newspapers. So that divorce would become something that everyone absolutely feared, and that would make them behave more morally in their marriages.
Why did that backfire?
Because within the first couple of years of the divorce court, it was completely evident that not only were English marriages much more unhappy than anyone had ever imagined, but much more was going on behind closed doors than could be conceived of. And so, for instance, just in 1859, just to give you some examples, yeah. There was the case of a man whose wife was concealing his brother in closets as he was coming home, with whom she was having an affair, yeah. Or the wife of a son of a banker with four children of her own who ran off with a groom. This is very much kind of Lady Chatterley-like stuff before
fantasy.
The fact.
Yeah.
Exactly. In those first 2 years of the divorce court, more people came to the divorce court than had tried to get a divorce in the previous century.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah. I just want you to tell the case of Annie Cheese.
That's right. So Annie Cheese was it's a fantastic name. Annie Cheese was the daughter of a respectable magistrate. She lands in the divorce court very shortly after its founding. And it's a complex case because her husband is bringing the case against her. The evidence that her marriage has, that she's committed adultery in her marriage, is brought by her own maid. And so it seems to be incontrovertible. She's run off to Paris with a man whom she's met, a friend of her husband's whom she's met when her husband was imprisoned in a divorce court. Mm-hmm. They've had a child together. So Annie Cheese essentially is, you know, the most contemptible sort of fallen woman. What happens in the divorce court, though, is it soon transpires that Annie's father has, in fact, manufactured this entire case. His daughter was a sinner, but he wanted to ensure that the divorce is made possible by kind of suppressing any evidence of her husband's bad behavior. Remember that I said that in order to get a divorce, you had to have one person the sinner and one person the innocent. In this case, both parties, right, were sinners. Mm-hmm. And James Cheese, Annie's father, who, as I said, was a very respectable person, just wanted to get his daughter away from her husband.
Yeah.
And this then becomes the occasion essentially for the creation of the Queen's Proctor, which is a snooping investigative arm of the divorce court, which is supposed to ensure that couples are not colluding with each other, or like in the case of Annie Cheese. Annie Cheese's case then gets even more incredible in some ways because the man she takes up with ends up as himself the guilty party in a divorce case later on. So you can see that these people whose lives are really literally wrecked by the divorce court. But interestingly, many cases, their parents stand by them. So only four women before the opening of the divorce court have been divorced in England
four
and Wales.
Four women!
Exactly. And
in
so
the whole history.
Right, so one of the horrifying things about the divorce court is it shows how many marriages are unhappy, but it also provides a way for wives to extricate themselves from what are really terrible marriages.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, fascinating, fascinating.
Newspapers like the Times keep this in discreet, you know, page 4, page 5 mm-hmm. of the newspapers. Other newspapers like the Pelham Gazette put it, sort of splash it all over the front pages.
And obviously people wanted it, and they still do, didn't
right.
they?
Right. People are tremendously interested. And this is one of the questions, right? On the one hand, the number of divorces is in the hundreds through the 19th century. On the other hand, everyone is convinced, and Alfred Austin, the poet and barrister, says this, that the divorce court has had a corrupting effect on morals, because what people who've committed adultery recognize is just how many people are like them. And if the original hope of the divorce court's framers was that forcing people to actually confess their sins was going to make them behave themselves, that wasn't the case, right? The number of adulterous couples just kept rising and rising.
Can you just tell us quickly about Drummond versus Drummond? Because I did find that fascinating.
Yes, this is a really tragic case in the 1860s. Harriet Capel, who was very much of a sort of scion of the aristocracy, hanging on to the margins of a poor aristocratic family. Her mother was the daughter, a Menard. Harriet Capel lands in the divorce court accusing her husband, Viscount Forth, of abusing her, of attacking her and of beating her, and also of being an adulterer. Mm-hmm. And what transpires during the case, as her mother is called to testify, is the first action of this new Queen's Proctor, this new investigative arm of the divorce court. Harriet's mother is forced to reveal that, in fact, Harriet has her own lover and that she's herself been an adulteress. And there's a lot of kind of intrigue in the court at this point, because it's not clear what this means. Does it mean actually that she's not going to be able to get a divorce, or will the court just take into account this adultery on the part of both parties mm-hmm. and say, well, this Forth is a cruel man, is a terrible husband? Or will the court actually refuse to give the divorce? And that's what happens. Mm-hmm. So the presiding judge is the extremely punitive Sir Cresswell Cresswell, who mm-hmm. is a curmudgeonly bachelor in his late 60s. Mm-hmm. And as the wags of the day.
I couldn't believe when I read that. He hadn't even been married.
No. He had a very curious choice, as the wags of the day put it, to actually command the fate of Britain's married women. And he essentially says a wife, and then as well a husband, who is guilty of adultery, themselves a sinner, will not be granted a divorce in this court. I'm not actually going to give away the story, but Annie Cheese's story and Harriet Capel's story are related.
Now we move on in the book to nature versus nurture debate, which is still going on. You looked at how the Victorians cared for their children with special needs.
That was really where I started my research. And I went into the records of the Normansfield Institute. And, you know, partly because we have an idea about the Victorians as being these secret keepers.
Yeah,
I went into these records thinking that children with special needs, children with learning difficulties mm-hmm. In the Victorian period, I imagined that they would have been secrets, like they especially were right, in the 20s and 30s, or after the 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. And so I went into these records, and at first I have to say I was completely baffled by them, because basically they're reams and reams and reams of files at the London Metropolitan Archive. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing for me was that it really wasn't until after the First World War. You could see signs of parents being embarrassed about those children mm-hmm. in the Edwardian period, but hidden away, not acknowledged, excluded from obituaries, that isn't until the 20s and 30s.
Now, why is that? Because you'd think after the First World War, people would be more liberated, if anything.
Right, exactly. Mm. This was exactly the assumption that I came in with, and what was completely upended.
Mm. So people were totally institutionalized, were they, then? In the
right, someone like Elizabeth Scott Sanderson was delivered to Normansfield when she was a little bit more than a year old, and she lived there, so far as we can know, for the rest of her life. Her mother came to visit her a couple of times a year when she was first institutionalized and then sort of sporadically thereafter. And in the entire time she was there, her father came to see her only twice. Wow. And when he died, she was omitted from his obituary. Amazing. And so literally it was as if this life had never been lived.
Our royal family had someone, didn't they?
That's right, Prince John.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of contention about whether to what extent he was hidden and what was the story of Prince John. But I think it's been established that he was epileptic. But
is
I think
that
it's
all?
Epilepsy, of course, hampered mental development and and repeated seizures. Yeah. In the Stephen Polyansky movie, mm-hmm. it was, or documentary, it was put forward this sort of idea about Prince John. And I know that there's been a lot of research after it contesting certain parts of the story. Mm-hmm. And of course, without access to the Royal Archives, one cannot know. Still, I think the high point of institutionalization was in the early 1960s. So it took a long time for the course to be reversed. In the early 1960s, 65,000 mentally disabled adults and children were institutionalized across Britain.
Now, then we come to the chapter called Other People's Bastards. Being illegitimate was a terrible thing. And people believed that so-called bastards were even bad people, you know, that they, you know, it would taint their personality.
Right, that there was a kind of moral degeneration that an illegitimate person bequeathed onto their children. So illegitimacy was really one of the most fundamental dividing lines in British law. This line between the legitimate and the illegitimate implicated all sorts of things, including whether one can inherit and from whom. The idea was, and this is centuries of common law, had established that the sins of the fathers and the mothers were really to be visited on the child. This was an enormous, enormous stigma. And it was an age-old stigma that had acquired a particular moral taint in the late 19th and early 20th century. Because remember, the Victorians, one of their signal accomplishments over the course of the 19th century is reducing illegitimacy rates from about 20% of births to 3% of births by the early 20th century.
What, just because of moral, giving out the moral message?
And workhouse punishments. I mean, all sorts. There's both the shame that was attached.
Away, do you think?
Well, and lots of people were forced into marriages at the last moment. But still, there was an absolute reduction in the amount of illegitimacy. Mm-hmm. So the story as it develops is really curious because it involves a kind of conflict between the ways in which civil servants thought about the entire issue of illegitimacy and adoption and the ways in which adopters did. And what I think is fascinating about this story is it shows how the kinds of arrangements that people made in families, in some ways very idiosyncratic arrangements that we might not think have any effect at all, in fact came to influence how civil servants thought about the entire question of, you know, whether illegitimacy mattered, whether everyone in the community needed to know about it. So when adoption was legalized in England and Wales in 1926.
Can't believe that.
Yeah, it's very, very
so
late. Yeah. So 1926 in England and Wales, 1930 in Scotland. Yeah. So when it was finally legalized, civil servants said, okay, the provision here is that you can legally terminate the natural parents' rights, the birth mother's rights, mm-hmm. but only on the condition that it is absolutely transparent. Well, you know, what they were afraid of was that if they told the child that they were adopted, that first of all, that they'd have to reckon with the fact of illegitimacy mm. and with everyone knowing the kind of stain of this child's birth. Mm. But they were also afraid that the child wouldn't love them as much. And this is where the sort of story of legislative history and family history comes together, is in a moment after the Second World War, when essentially the entire rules around adoption and around birth certificates are changed explicitly to conceal illegitimacy. So you have the introduction after the Second World War of a new form of birth certificate that is called the short birth certificate, made a fifth of the price of the long birth certificate, specifically so that no one would know that the person was adopted.
Okay, so it didn't have to put on certain details.
Then. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, illegitimacy doubled over the course. Over the course of the Second World War.
People were having good time.
Yeah, right. 8% of births, you know, in the last years of the war are reckoned to have been illegitimate births.
Wow.
So there was a need, absolutely, to try to protect the interests of these children.
And very interesting, that was the start of a baby boom as well.
Right.
We've heard about the illegitimate children, but the mothers, I think, were treated terribly as well, the way the babies were yanked away. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, they're tremendously sad stories. So imagine if you open up an adoption file, what you see are letters from a desperate mother who is trying somehow to figure out how either to keep her baby and make provisions for it or to put the child up for adoption. Then you have the adoption secretary, who is the person who's brokering this whole arrangement. And you have the potential adopters who are writing in to get these babies. And then sometimes after 1975, when people get the right to consult their adoption files and to learn something, more adopted people write into the adoption agencies. And so you have correspondence from them. So you have a very long chronological span of seeing the workings out of these adoptions. So the mothers, in some cases, women wrote every year asking for pictures of their children.
Never ever received.
Some of the adoption secretaries were kind and merciful and tried to get those. Some adopters refused to give those pictures because they wanted right to break that link and to deny, in a sense, that mother ever existed. Mm. And in a sense, what was said to women at the time who surrendered those babies was that this was the best thing they could do for their child, that they would soon go on, that they would get married, that they would have other children, and that they would forget what had happened to them. And that was a lie. I mean, that may have been true for some people, but it's a rare person who ends up in an adoption file.
And how many weeks or did they have the child before they had to give them up?
The old practice in mother and baby homes was actually 6 months. So the idea was...
That's some really big bombs.
Yeah, so six... And actually, in a mother and baby home, partly what they were trying to achieve before there was legal adoption was they wanted the mother to be forced into a reckoning with what she'd done. And they wanted mothers to actually keep their bastards because it was only in that way that she would truly be punished. Actually, funnily enough, because we have this perception, and this is very much the American story, where babies are taken away, sort of instantly they're born, they're taken away. Mm. That wasn't the case in Britain. If anything, it was that adoption agencies had to push to try to reform practices, which were that the mother would actually have the child for quite a long time.
I know you've only studied it, but what's you're a mother, what's your emotional reaction? Do you think it's harder the longer you have the child? What do you think? Do you think quickly taking it away?
I think either thing is... So I mean, the possibilities for regret are so enormous. I'm just thinking about one of the mothers whom I write about who relinquishes a child. And this is a particularly heartbreaking case because she's really a fallen woman. She's given birth not just to one illegitimate child, but to a second. And that really put her beyond the pale. I mean, so much so that women in the workhouse who had given birth to two illegitimate children were in some workhouses forced to wear a special uniform to denote their... particularly fallen character. God. This woman is a munitions worker. She gives birth to a second illegitimate child during the First World War. And then when she relinquishes the older daughter, the girl who is at that point, three years old. And I think it's a particularly heartbreaking thing. She does it, I think, because she's told that the girl is more likely to be adopted, which was true.
Girls were wanted.
Girls were...
Just expand on that. Why do you think that was?
I think for two reasons. One is there was a perception that they would be much more malleable. And so in a moment, when these are adopters who are really valuing nurture over nature, there's still a sense that you can mold a girl.
Yeah.
And then also that a girl is going to take care of aged parents, that she's likely to stay home. Yeah. She's much more likely to be tied to them. Mm. So this woman, when she gives up her three-year-old daughter, and then really comes pretty soon thereafter to have tremendous regrets about this.
Oh.
And what I have to say about this adoption agency, though, is that in the case where a mother gave birth to a child intending to place this child for adoption but changed her mind, they would do what they could to actually help her get back on her feet. Once you signed the paperwork, it was very hard to get the child back. But before you did, you could absolutely retain control of your baby. And the entire force of the law until 1949 was to enable you to do so.
The next section we go to is bachelor uncles. And we can all guess what that means. But it seems to be that working class and being gay was better than middle class, the research you found in the 20th century.
Right. Here I'm drawing too on the research of Matt Holbrook in Queer London, who talks about a number of cases where the queen...
Yeah, spelled differently than normal queen.
Right, this Q-U-E-A-N, which is very much of a sort of terminology both of the time and also resuscitated now.
Mm.
The queen, the sort of flamboyant feminine character, was a recognized persona in working class neighborhoods. And in particular, he talks about a man named Alex Purdy, who's works in a market stall in the East End. The fact he was a queen, there was nothing hiding it. It was patently obvious. And again, when we come to middle class families, then the question is, what are the neighbors going to think?
Mm-hmm.
And the imperative to respectability. So what's interesting about the story that I'm telling is that in many cases, a man's homosexuality was known to be known, but also sort of never discussed with him in the family.
Yeah.
So queer men or gay men say, well, it was never talked about in my family. But if you go and look at what their relatives are saying, their relatives are oftentimes say, well, it's discussed constantly. There's a lot of very interesting oral history material from the 40s and 50s, both about that point and also looking back at the 20s and 30s, talking about the terms in which homosexuality would be discussed within families. You know, in middle-class families, in a sense, whatever tolerance men found in their families was really predicated on their own silence.
Yeah, it must have been hard because you looked at the case of the famous gay Christopher Isherwood, who wrote Goodbye to Berlin, which was the basis of Cabaret. His mother gave birth to two gay sons. That must have been hard for her.
Well, and she was viewed in her family, and again, this is a good example of how it's discussed very openly in that family, known as poor Aunt Kathleen. And Isherwood is both very funny and also quite merciless with his mother because, as he says, she's the kind of person who really doesn't want to acknowledge, you know, what stands right before her.
Yeah.
And
double whammy though.
And he actually, he came out to her, which, again, is a relatively unusual thing in the 1920s.
Yeah, because I've even got friends that have never come out to their parents now, you know.
Right.
It's just never said.
Right, you know? Right. And sometimes that's because, you know, men or women feel that they don't want to discuss the subject or they don't want to injure their family or why rock the boat? Things are fine as they are.
Yeah. What about being a lesbian? How difficult was that?
My research was largely about the, you know, gay uncle or the bachelor uncle because it was only male homosexuality with, it was sex between men, whether it happened in public or in private, that was criminalized in Britain. And so lesbians were literally sort of operated beyond the boundaries of the law. And what they gave them, that extra legal quality, but also the fact that women's friendships and women's kind of intimacy with each other, as the literary scholar Sharon Marcus has really brilliantly argued in her book Between Women, was in a way a sort of prop, an adjunct to marriage. So there was always a plausible deniability that the headmistress and her companion who lived together, and there are many, many, many such instances.
Were at my school.
Yes, were that was a friendship.
Yes.
The same thing wasn't true for men, in part because after the trials of Oscar Wilde, after the sort of increasing focus on defining and identifying male homosexuality, that there was more suspicion that attached to men.
Said, I mean, especially, you reviewed the book Singled Out by Virginia Nicholson, didn't you?
Now, yeah.
That's one of my favorite books ever, by the way, apart from yours. but she is going on about, so women after the Second World War, they didn't find husbands. And I mean, when I was growing up, I literally remember lots of kind of spinsterish people living together. Now, whether they were gay or not, no one ever.
Right. And who would have known? And
there's no suspicion.
Yeah.
They could have get away with it socially, couldn't they?
Right.
Whereas a man couldn't.
Right. Well, and also you see, I'm thinking about cases like Tony Garrett, who introduces the writer Angus Wilson to his parents as his best friend.
Yes.
And everyone says, oh, you know, how nice.
Yeah.
and then they go in. We don't know what the parents actually said within the family. Mm-hmm. But that was certainly Garrett's impression.
Yeah. And also maybe men being gay, it's harder if they are a flamboyant gay to kind of hide that, you know.
And this is what Matt Holbrook has talked about in Queer London, is that the kind of very clearly identifiable difference between homosexual and heterosexual, which we think has existed for a very long time, is a very, very recent vintage. So that you could have men who had sex with other men without thinking of themselves in the slightest bit as quote-unquote abnormal or deviant or in any way. And that's the sort of
Because
classic
most
case.
Men in Victorian times were married, weren't they? Because they had to have the double life.
Or they were bachelors and confirmed bachelors. Yeah. Or, I mean, the real example is the guardsman, who's the kind of famous example. And one of the men whom I talk about in the book has many, many, many relationships with guardsmen. And in fact, one of those guardsmen and his wife end up taking care of him as a very old man.
Wow. I love it, the Guardsman.
Yeah.
Sounds very sexy, yeah. I think it was all happening in Hyde Park, actually.
That's right,
that
the
was
Guardsman.
The place. That was the picking up area of the Victorian days, wasn't it?
Right, and well into the 20th century,
oh, really?
Too.
Really?
One of the things Holbrooke does in his book is really map out where sex is happening, all the different locales in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah. Whereas women have just always been more underground. They've always just, you know, it's a more subtle thing, isn't it? You know. And then I want to now move to the chapter called The Repressive Family, which emerged in the 60s, which was a time of social change. People became very interestingly anti-family and they sought out different ways of living.
Right. So, I mean, there's a very fascinating change that happens. So in the aftermath of the Second World War, the idea is that the family is fragile, it's imperiled, but it's absolutely vital. It's the building block of society. 10 years later, the idea is not that the family is imperiled, but rather that it's enormously powerful and incredibly repressive. Mm-hmm. And all sorts of people are making arguments about the family's capacity for repression. So from the anti-psychiatry movement of Artie Lang and David Cooper in the 1960s into the early 1970s to feminism and gay rights in the 1970s, which very much takes up these ideas about the ways in which the family familial privacy is cloaked all kinds of repression and all kinds of horrible things that happened behind closed doors, which is undoubtedly true.
Yeah.
In this time of the 20s and 30s, when you have this intense nuclear family and more families start to look alike, they have the same number of children, right? Victorians had either large numbers of children or they could have small numbers of children, but there was a wide variation in what counted as normal.
Yeah, 1950s sort of perfect mother with the apron, Labrador dog.
Right, right.
And Peter and Jane, the books I brought
exactly.
up on.
Yeah, exactly. And it's true in the sense that families looked more and more alike. People got married around an 8-year band. Marriage was pretty much universal from the late 1930s, very unlike the Victorians who have these large supply of spinsters and bachelors, aunts. So the attack then that comes on the family as this tremendously repressive force is interesting to me because it's the moment where you really see the definition of privacy change, right? Privacy has been understood as a familial prerogative, right? It's the family's privacy that has to be protected. It's the right to keep its affairs to itself, to keep them from nosy neighbors.
Yeah. What cases did you give, you know, like this in the book?
What I was very interested in reading files from the Tavistock Clinic was a set of case files from the late 50s and early 60s where you can really begin to register the discontent that people who come to the Tavistock, which are admittedly a self-selected group, right? Mm-hmm. They come, they're interested in analytic questions. Yeah, they hope so that they're going to find...
They're the North London intelligentsia.
Yeah. Although it's a broader spectrum than that. I mean, that's what you expect
yes,
to find
there. Yes,
you
do, there. The Hampstead
but, yeah, right, precisely. But that's not actually... I mean, partly people would be referred to the Tavistock from their by their GP. And so it's actually a broader social range. Mm-hmm. But more than that, there's an explosion through the late 1960s and late 1970s and early 1970s of what one can say about the family and what people all of a sudden feel free to say from, you know, the famous Edmund Leach lecture, his Reith lecture from 1967, where he says the family with its narrow privacy and tawdry secrets is the source of all of our discontents. And people write him, I mean, he gets floods of correspondence, and most of it from people who say, you have finally expressed what I've always felt in my heart about families but have not dared to actually say aloud. And so this sense of a kind of groundswell of reevaluation of what families mean.
But just think how much families have changed since then. Families, acceptable now to be single parent, to be gay. You know, I mean, in a way, that was like the kind of explosion, and now we are living it. You know?
Right, absolutely. And I think, you know, all credit to feminism, in fact, and to gay rights.
Gay rights, yeah.
Both of those, because when you have, you know, in 1964, Juliette Mitchell has this rapturous passage where she says, well, imagine if families... you know, weren't just the kind of nuclear family that had been attacked, but instead single people living together, people living, you know, divorced people, people raising children together. And it's a rhapsodic passage, but in fact, it's what happened. The reconfiguration of the family is really something that feminism and gay rights have brought about, so much so that our idea of what counts as the normal family is really utterly changed.
It has. And at this point, I'm going to say Deborah Cohen It has been a joy to interview on Radio Gorgeous today.
It has been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for having me.
If you'd like to contact us, please email us on info@radiogorgeous or like us on Facebook or become part of our community. Just sign up your name on our website and we'll send an e-letter to you a few times a month.